We're holding on page 18 in Yerushalmi Shkolim, about the middle of Ois Lamed. We learned yesterday about several different opinions about how the Dibros were arranged on the Luchos. We had Rav Hanani ben Gamliel saying that there were five Dibros on each Luach as we usually picture them. But then we had the Rabbanon said all 10 were written on one Luach and then they're written again on another Luach. And Rav Shimon ben Yochai says they were written, the whole Dibros were written twice on each Luach. So you have 20 on each one and 20 on each one. And then Rav Simoi says there was 40 times on 40 Dibros on each Luach, meaning that the Dibros were written four times on each one. So HaKosev over here gives a diagram to illustrate when you say that they were written 20 or 40 times, 20 or 40 dibros on each luach. He pictures it that you have right side up and upside down, as he has in the illustration over here. And then, according to Reb Simo, you would have the same thing on the back of the luchos. There are other opinions among Mefoshim that say that it would mean that according to Reb Shimon, it would mean they were written on the two sides, and according to Reb Simo, they were written on the four sides, every side except for the top and bottom. So what the significance of that is, why would they have to be repeated, or why would they have to be repeated more than one time? So HaKosev gives a long explanation over here, where one thing he points out is that you could look at it like this. I mean, you have, of course, you have the simple, you have the simple thing that the Dibros were written all together one time. But one thing is, if you did it that way, if you have five on one luach and five on the other, as if, so to speak, there wasn't enough room on the first luach, and you have to go to another page. I'll dare, like when you're writing something, the problem with that is, given that the last five Dibros are ben Adam l'chaveiros strictly, and they don't even have Hashem's name in them, loisirtzach, loisinaf, etc., Hashem's name is never mentioned in them. So you might think they're less important. They're secondary to the other ones, as though like they're like the leftover. It was like whatever couldn't be fit on the second one, then they got shunted over to the second luach. So the Rabbanan preferred to say that all of them were written on each luach to stress that each one of them is just as important as the other. Then you have Reb Shimon ben Yochai goes further. He says the fact is, you have Tam Elyon and Tam Tachton. So you have different ways of reading the words of the psukim. There are different ways of putting together the sentences, and sometimes even it makes for a difference in nikud. For example, you have in Tam Elyon versus Tam Tachton, for example, when you get to Lo Yiyah L'chayim Achayim Al Ponai, so in Tam Tachton, where each pasuk, where you have some of the longer dibros, like Lo Yiyah L'cha and Zachar, are divided into multiple psukim. So the word there is ponoi with a comet, because there you have a sof pasuk, and in a sof pasuk, a patach often changes to a comet. On the other hand, in Tam Elyon, as we read it in Shul, the word is ponai with a patach, because there you don't have an esnachta or a sof pasuk. There you have in Tam Elyon, you have a segel. You have a zarka and then a segel, and that's not a strong enough to change a comet into a patach, turn a patach into a comet. And you have a number of other examples like that. Loi tirtzach, for example, in Tam Elyon, the way we read it in Shul, loi tirtzach. So you have a tipcha on the word loy, and the word tirtzach, therefore, the same thing with tinaf and tignoiv, has a dogish in it, as you would always after a separating terup, as opposed to in tam tachton, loy sirtzach, loy sinaf, etc., where there you have a connecting terup, you have a mercha on the loy, and therefore the sof is rafa. So you have several examples like that. So one way of looking at it is then that, aside from the fact that, again, you want to stress the importance of all the dibros relative to one another, there's an addition. There's two different ways to read the dibros. So that's another reason why they should have to be repeated. And then Reb Simoi goes further and says, the fact is, you also have, there's the simple meaning of it, and then you have the Torah Sanister. You have the whole Pnimiyas HaTorah behind it. So therefore, that would be a reason to write them yet again, and that would be, according to him, a reason why altogether they should be written four times on each Luach. And then Yefei Mare explains somewhat similarly. He says that you have there's the again there's Nigla and there's Nister, and then you also have the Tagim and the various other things that decorate the letters. Those have layers of meaning of their own, so therefore it has to be written again in order to incorporate all of that. So the Radvaz also has a couple of tshuvas on the subject, where he deals with this Gemara in some detail, also discussing why, according to the various opinions, the Dibros would have to be written multiple times. Part of it overlaps with what we're saying over here from Akosev and Yifei Mara and the rest of them. But one thing is also he points out that the machlokas may be like this. If you looked at the, like we talked about yesterday, if you looked at the luchos from the reverse side, what would you see? Would you see, as the Bavli has it in Shabbos, that you would see the letters in the shape of letters, in the shape of letters in Lashon Kodesh, but the words would be written backwards, so that, for example, a word like Nevuv would be written Beis Vav, Beis Nun, backwards? Or would you say that, no, you would actually, B'derech Nes, you would read it forward on the back side as well, so then that can count as another writing of the Luchos. You can also talk about, for example, would it be B'derech Nes, that you would also see it completely as actual words on the sides of the luchos, that in other words, it was only engraved, mizeo mizehem ksuvim, they're engraved through and through from one side to the other, but b'derech nes, almost like a hologram, you would see it on the other sides, you would see it or like a kaleidoscope or something, b'derech nes, you would see it reflected on the other sides as well. So in that case, we can well say that the dibris were written multiple times on each luach. Okay, the Gemara continues. Hananya ben Achir of Yeshua Omar, Bein Dibur le Dibur Diktukeho Voisia Sehel Shal Torah. In addition, it's not just the Luchos didn't just have the words of the Aseres HaDibros on them, between one word and another, there were written all the details and all the osius of Torah, meaning, in other words, like this. We know that the Aseres HaDibros incorporate within them all 613 mitzvahs. Rashi mentions it on a pasuk bringing from Reb Sadia Gaon. Reb Sadia Gaon famously wrote a piyut, which is said Ada Yemazeh in Sfardish Kehilas on Shavuos, where he shows how each of the Aseres HaDibros incorporates within it dozens of mitzvahs, and all 613 mitzvahs can be summarized under the headings of the Aseres HaDibros. Agav, there's also a very famous sefer that was written on that. A Talmud Chacham a little over 100 years ago, named Rabbi Yerucham Fishel Perla, wrote a famous sefer on that Azharis of Reb Sadia Gaon, a very lumdish sefer, analyzing in detail every word and every letter of Reb Sadia's expression when he mentions a particular mitzvah, the exact wording that he used or didn't use, and what we can derive from that about Reb Sadia's opinion about the geder and about the details of a particular mitzvah. It's a tremendous sefer of lomdus, very popular in the yeshivas. It was said on the this Rabbi Yerucham Fishel Perla. It's said about him. He sat for I think 14 years or something in his attic writing it without barely going outside, and afterwards, when it came out, one of the great Talmud Chachamim, one of the Gedolei Yisrael of that time, said this is the kind of thing it would take 40 years for a person to even have the ability to write such a thing. Anyway, so
how many volumes is it?
I think it came out in 3 volumes. And this is all based on one poem of Reb Sadia Gaon, where each mitzvah is summarized in like one line or half a line or something. Yeah. So there's a tremendous lomdusha sefer. Anyway, the point is, so here, Rechananya ben Achir of Yeshua is saying that on the luchos themselves, you would see between the words and between the letters of the Aseres HaDibros, you'd see all the details of the Torah, all the detailed mitzvahs, all the details of each mitzvah, etc. Because Hananya says we can learn that from the posik. The posik describes there's a posik in Shir HaShirim, mimuloyim katarshish, filled up like tarshish. Now, in the simple sense, it means the posik is describing the beginning of the posik, yod of glilei zahav, his hands, so to speak, of Hashem that are described in the psukim over there, are like golden rods, like golden pillars, mimuloyim batarshish, that are inlaid with tarshish, which in Parsha to Pshat is a precious stone. It's one of the stones on the Choshen. But now we're understanding the Yod of Glilei Zahav refers to the Luchos. Rashi, in fact, mentions on the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim that they're Glilei in the sense that even though they were made out of sapphire, B'derech Nes, they could be rolled up as though they were a Sefer Torah. So Glilei, Meloshen Nigla, like rolling up a Sefer Torah. And Memoloyim Batarshish, Batarshish, filled up like Tarshish, where one meaning of Tarshish, besides that it means a precious stone, also means the ocean, Tiyama Rabba, meaning that the luchos are filled up like the great sea. Meaning, what does that mean? How does the great sea have to do with the details of Torah? Omer Eshlokish ki moti Rabbi Yochanan lahaykra, when Rabbi Yochanan would reach this pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Omar, he would say, Yofalim dani Hananya ben Achir Rabbi Yeshua. Hananya, the nephew of Rabbi Yeshua, taught me well. He explained very well how we get from the words Memoloyim Katarshish this that he's saying that all the details of Torah were there on the Luchos. Ma hayam hazeh, just like in the ocean, ben gal godel le gal godel, gal cotton, between one large wave and another, there are smaller waves. So you look at the sea from the distance, and all you see is the big waves. But you get closer and you take a look, and you see that there are much smaller waves between the bigger ones, which you couldn't see from a distance. Kain ben dibur le dibur, the same way. From a distance, you would look at the luchas, and all you'd see is the dibris. But you look closer, diktu kel, where you see a seir shal Torah, and you would find over there all the details and all the osias of Torah. So in that sense, that's what the pasuk means. Memuloyim katarshish, that just like the sea is full of larger waves and then smaller and smaller waves between the larger ones, so it was with the luchas. So in other words, in short, the point is again that the Aseres HaDibros incorporate within them the whole Torah, and therefore the luchas didn't just include the 170 odd words of the Aseres HaDibros, but it included so much more than that. So the Gemara continues, another special thing about the Torah. Reb Pinchas b'shem Reish Lakish Omar, Torah shenosan HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe, this Torah that Hashem gave to Moshe, nitna loy be'esh levona charusa be'esh shchora. It was given to him as white fire engraved with black fire. So Parshat Pshat, in other words, is the same way as a Sefer Torah. You have white parchment, and on it you have black letters. So here, the Torah that Hashem gave Moshe Rabbeinu, miminoi, from his right hand, as we have in this week's parasha, esh dos lomoi, it was a Torah of fire that he gave them. So therefore, so the parchment and the letters are both fire, which we always have. And in Chassidus, we always compare the flow of energy that we get from Hashem. We always compare it to light. And fire is a type of light for a variety of reasons that are mentioned in earlier Sifrei Kabbalah. Basically, it boils down to that light is, even though it has gashmiistic properties, we're able to perceive it with our eyes and we're able to measure it scientifically, but it has no mass. It has no. It's the most spiritual thing that we have in our physical world, and therefore it's in many ways it's the best analogy for the energy that we get from Hashem. So therefore, in the same vein, we're using that as a metaphor for the energy for the Chochmah Seir Ratzon and Shalach Kadosh Baruch Hu that he put into the Torah. So what it means specifically, white fire and black fire. So there's various ideas. There's one general thing is, in general, we often find that white is the color of chesed and black is one of the colors of gvura. So it represents that the Torah is the Eibishter gives it to us as chesed, but it's nishtalshel through gvura, as the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya, for example, that we have the mitzvahs are the mitzvahs are sort of squeezed down and limited and constrained into physical things. We have this particular physical thing that has to be done, that has to be used for this mitzvah, and that one for that mitzvah. And everyone has a particular minimum and often maximum shear. So in that sense, we talk about Torah is related to Gvura, and we even have the expression that Torah is nitna mipi ha-Gvura. It's given from the mouth of the Gvura. So the Eish Shchorda Agave Eish Levona represents that. In Hemshech Ayin Beis, there's a place where the Rebbe Rashab talks about that the white fire represents the Atzmus Oren Soif, and the black fire represents the Oren Soif as it comes into the Kalim. So similar idea, when the Or comes into Kalim, then it has to be, it goes through a process of Tzimtzum to be able to be in those Kalim. So there's that idea, and Tzimtzum is a function of Gvura. So you have a similar idea, therefore, so it can be described as black fire of Oris and Kalim on a background of white fire of Or and Sof Shalifnat Tzimtzum. And he continues, he esh, the Torah itself is fire, muvlelas be'esh, it's blended with fire, chatsuva me'esh, it's carved out of fire, then unasuna me'esh, and it's given from amidst the fire, shenema, as the pasuk says, mimino esh dos lomoy, from Hashem's right hand, he gave them a Torah of fire. So therefore, in every way, we can compare the Torah to fire. Eitz Yosef points out the four expressions over here can refer to the four olamos abya. In every one of the four olamos, you can speak of an aspect of Torah which is like fire. And then Moshe Rabbeinu learned the Torah on all those four levels. Now here the Ein Yaakov brings in a piece which is not actually from the Gemara and Shkolim over here. It's actually from the Yerushalmi Times. But he points out, so it has to do with the luchos, it has to do with the breaking of the luchos specifically. And he says, since we were talking about the properties of the luchos, the size of them and the writing of them and so on and so forth, so therefore we may as well bring in over here something about the size of the luchos and about what happened right before Moshe broke them. So Reb Shmuel bar Nachmeni Omar, haluchos are your oken shisha tfachim, v'rochman shisha tfachim. The luchos are six tfachim long and six wide. When at one point Moshe is holding on to two tefachim of them, Hashem is holding on to the other two, and then there's two that are not being held in the middle between them. When the Jewish people did that thing, namely they made the egel. So Hashem wanted, so to speak, to grab them away from Moshe, to start with the two tefachim that he's holding and grab the other four. The Gavra Yadosh Moshe, but Moshe, so to speak, overpowered Hashem, and he grabbed them away from Hashem and then broke them. Thus Hashem praises him at the very end of the Torah, the last pasuk of the Torah, with all the mighty hand. What do you mean mighty? I mean and Hashem tells him earlier in the Torah, Asher Shibarta, where Yehei Shloma al Yoda de Govra al Yamina. May there be peace to the hand of Moshe that, so to speak, overpowered the right hand of Hashem and grabbed the luchos away from him.
What would happen if he would take it? We wouldn't have completely, he wouldn't even break it, and we wouldn't have the second one.
We wouldn't have the second ones, right. So Akosev again goes into a long thing over here to try and explain him, and how do we explain a gashmiistic statement like that about Hashem, and he explains that actually what it means is, in other words, that Hashem knew already at that point that they had made the egel. He tells Moshe Lechred. So at that point, Hashem wants to withhold the luchos and let them stay by him rather than giving them to Moshe to give to the Jewish people. Moshe, who had not yet himself seen that they have that they had made the egel, as far as he's concerned at that point, he's still going to go down and give the luchos to the Jewish people. So therefore, he was holding on to them, and he, so to speak, wrested them away from Hashem, as if to say, in other words, no, they're not going to stay up here in Shemayim. I am going to bring them down to the Jewish people, come what may. Then when he comes down the mountain and he sees with his own eyes that they're actually making the egel, and as we learn, you know, even though you don't do things by hearsay, even though obviously Moshe knew that Hashem is telling the absolute emes, nevertheless he still had to see it with his own eyes. So then Taki threw them down and broke them. But that's the significance of that. Akosev explains is that it means that Hashem would have wanted to keep the luchos by him and not have them be given to the Jewish people at all. And Moshe, so to speak, overpowered him and said that no, they have to be given to the Jewish people no matter what. And then when the result was, they had to be broken because of the Chet Egel, that eventually there has to be a second set, of luchos.
You say something that had to be broken.
Then it had to be brought to the Jewish people. At that point, when Moshe, so to speak, grabbed it away from Hashem, it's like, he, as far as he's concerned, he's going to still come down from Har Sinai and give it to them. Then when he saw that there was the egel, then that's different. So then we're saying, in other words, that Hashem agreed with Moshe that was the right thing to do. And then he goes on and explains what the significance is of saying that the luchos was 6x6 tefachim, because, in other words, that you have the amount that a person can hold with his hands is two tefachim, one tefach for each hand. So therefore, so that's why we're describing the luchos as that size, to represent, in other words, this ruchniistic point of how the Torah was, so to speak, an object of contention at that point between Hashem and Moshe Rabbeinu. Eitz Yosef brings over here a different point from Or Chodosh, from the Maharal's Sefer of that name. The Maharal also discusses this in another place in his Svarim, that you can look at it like this. The Torah has, we know that there are, well, so here actually, so what he brings here from Or Chodosh is that there are three different groups of mitzvahs within the Aseret HaDibros themselves. You have Ben Odom Lamokim, which is the first two Dibros primarily, Then you have the mitzvahs. Then you have things that are both Bein Adam L'Makom and Bein Adam L'Chaveri, because Lo Sisa, for example, it has to do between you and Hashem, that you shouldn't use Hashem's name in vain, but it also has to do with other people in that you shouldn't swear falsely in Beis Din, for example, and the same thing with Shabbos, and the same thing with Kibbud Av Va'Em. Then you have the third group, which are exclusively or almost exclusively Bein Adam L'Chaveri, namely from Lo Sirtzach till the end. So therefore, so that's represented by, you have two tefachim that are held by Hashem, so to speak, representing the first couple of dibros, two tefachim at the other end that are being held by Moshe, representing the ones that are exclusively Bein Adam L'Chaveri, and then you have two tefachim in between, representing the mitzvahs that are a little bit of both. That's one explanation over here. And then, so now when it came to the Chet Ha'Egel, so now that's an Aveira Bein Adam L'Makom. So therefore, so now Hashem wanted to say in that case that they violated the mitzvah Bein Adam L'Makom. Therefore, I should take the whole thing away. But Moshe says, no, on the other hand, they haven't sinned Bein Adam L'Chaveroi. Therefore, they still deserve to have the luchos, and therefore he took them and therefore he grabbed them away from Hashem. Elsewhere, Maharal makes a different point as well, that you have also, you know, there's Eidus, Chukim, and Mishpatim. And another way you can look at it is also the Chukim are exclusive to Hashem, only he knows the true reasons for them. Mishpatim are the ones that we understand with our logical brain. And then the Eidus are someplace in between, so therefore the two Tfachim that Hashem is holding on to represent the Chukim, the two that Moshe is holding on to represent the Mishpatim, and the two that are between them that neither one is holding on to represent the Eidus. So then the Gemara continues. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Haluchos Hayim Vakshin Lifroyach. Not only that, the Luchos themselves wanted to fly out of Moshe's hand when Moshe comes down and sees the Chet Ha'Egel. So the Luchos themselves were ready to fly out of his hands. Why should we be brought down to such a people? Vayim Moshe Tofsan. So Moshe had to grab a hold of them to keep them from flying off. Hainu Dichtiv Va'espes B'Shnei Haluchos. That explains when Moshe says, "I grabbed a hold of the Luchos." What do you mean, "I grabbed a hold of them"? He's holding them the whole time. It means he had to grab them to keep them from flying away. So it also fits with the previous Rasha that he had to, so to speak, grab them away from Hashem. Tony Reb Yudan, then Reb Yudan teaches a drasha, teaches a braisa, haluchos hayu masia aboim sa. The luchos weighed 40 sa. A sa is really a measurement of volume, not of weight. But if we think of a sa in terms of a volume of water, then 40 sa is, after all, a shiur mikveh. In terms of water, it would come out, according to different poskim, anywhere between about 80 and 200 gallons. A gallon is about 8 pounds. So you're talking, even on the smallest measure, you're talking about well over 600. You're talking well over 600 pounds. And according to the maximum, you're talking about close to a ton. So they weighed quite a bit. And on top of that, we're saying they ran out of sapphire, which is weight for weight. Sapphire is a lot heavier than water. So we're talking about they weighed thousands of pounds. I'm saying, in other words, when we say 40 sa, the volume of the luchos would be equal to the volume, would be equal to the weight of the weight of the luchos would be equal to the weight of 40 sa of water. Because sa is really a measure of volume. So there's a connection between Torah and mikveh, definitely, yeah, because the Torah is a mikveh tara for a person, yeah. V'hoyak sav sovlon. Now, how is it that Moshe is able to carry such heavy luchos? Because the writing made it possible to carry them. The way alderach like the neshama in the body, alderach like you have. The Gemara and elsewhere mentions the idea. Chai noseh satzma. You carry a living person. And because they're alive and they adjust their weight accordingly, it's much easier to carry them than it would be a dead body of the same weight. So the same way, when the luchos have their neshama, which is the letters within them, then that made it relatively easy for Moshe to carry them. Kibin shaparach haksav. But then when the letters flew away, when he saw what's going on with the eagle and the letters flew off, kovdu al yodeh, then all of a sudden they're extremely heavy for him. They're kovdu al yodeh shal Moshe. They were extremely heavy for Moshe's hands. Vinishtabru, and therefore they broke. So it's not even like Moshe broke them, but rather almost like they dropped from his hands automatically because all of a sudden now they're so heavy and therefore they broke. So in fact, Akosiv says just that's what it means. In other words, that basically they fell on their own and they broke. He mentions also, as far as the six tfachim, he says you could say like this, that you have. There's Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebalpeh, so that's represented by the first two Tvachim. then you have that. Then you have another two tefachim representing that. So you have two tefachim held by Hashem and two held by Moshe, representing. In other words, you have Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, which were given by Hashem to Moshe. So therefore, we can picture the luchos as each of them holding two tefachim, representing that at that point each of them is holding Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, and then the middle two tefachim, which neither one is holding, represents that anybody can come and learn Torah if they want. So, like, so to speak, they're available. They're not being held by either one. They're available for a person to learn.
Six.
So therefore, two, two, and two is six. Two that Hashem is holding, two that Moshe is holding at the other end, and two in the middle. So that's the thing. So one way of understanding it is that the two tefachim represent Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh. The two tefachim at the other end also represent Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, meaning because Hashem has Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh and is giving it to Moshe. And then you have two in between to represent that anybody can come and learn Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, almost as if like anybody could go and grab a hold of the two middle tefachim. Then he says also, the sixth tefachim size of the luchos, says HaKosev, can also represent the Shisha Sidre Mishnah, and in turn, the Shisha Sidre Gemara that we have on them. Because again, like we said before, the luchos had on them not just the Aseres Adibris, but all of the details of Torah. So therefore, the very size of the luchos represented the future, that in the future, there's going to be Shisha Sidre Mishnah and six Sdorim of Gemara on them. Okay, so that ends the part that discussing the Oren and the Luchos and all of that. So now to continue, in the Mishnah at one point it's mentioned so like this. We learned in the first Mishnah of the Perek that there were 13 places in the Bais HaMikdash where you were supposed to bow down when you came to the Bais HaMikdash, and you would walk around the whole complex. There were 13 places you were supposed to bow. One opinion in the Mishnah is that it corresponds to the 13 gates of the Azara. So now there's different opinions. The Gemara points out, the Yerushalmi points out over here, the Bavli points out in some other places that there were actually different opinions among the Tanoim how many gates there were in the Azara. But Pashtus is not a Macholikus B'Metzius. But the question really is which ones actually deserve the title gates versus which ones are more like a pishposh, like a side gate, like not really an important gate. Anyway,
when they're bowing with the back to the pishposh or to the gate. Into the Bais HaMikdash.
They're bowing into the Bais HaMikdash. Obviously, they're not going to turn their backs to the Bais HaMikdash. Yeah. So there is an opinion that there were 13 gates of the Azara. So then the Mishnah goes and lists all of them. Now, one of them is called Shar HaMayim. So the Mishnah says it was one of the gates on the south. They called it Shar HaMayim because the Mishnah says, first of all, they would bring the Tzloiches Shamayim. Here we're coming up to Sukkos now. We have the Nisuch HaMayim every day of Sukkos. So they would fill up the flask of water from the Shiloyach spring, which is in the south of Yerushalayim. And then they would bring it up to the Har HaBayis, and they would bring it into the Azara through one of the gates on the south, which therefore was called Shar HaMayim. Then the Mishnah mentions that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says there's another reason why that gate was called Shar HaMayim, because he says there's boy mayim mefakim, there's water that trickles out from that gate, and he says vasidin lius yotzin mitachas miftan abayis. In the future, in the third Bais HaMikdash, there's going to be water trickling from under the threshold of the heichal, and it's going to become a huge stream, which is going to traverse all of Eretz Yisrael. So Yechezkel describes it in the most detail in Yechezkel Perek Mem Zayin. We learned about it when we went through Ein Yaakov and Yuma in the last Perek. The Bavli had a whole sugya about it, some of which we're going to have here in the Yerushalmi as well.
They found
you have the channel over there that they dug underground, that they dug to bring the water from the Gichon spring to the Shiloyach spring that Chizkiyahu built in his time. No, we're talking about that La'osid Lava. There's going to be the Gemara, the Bavli describes it in more detail in Yuma, and the Yerushalmi describes it over here in a piece that's not here in Ein Yaakov, that what you have is it starts in the Kodesh HaKadoshim as a tiny trickle, and then as it goes further and further away from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, it becomes a bigger and bigger stream, representing, in other words, that you have the Kedusha, the Elikos, the Gilui Elikos that comes out from the Kodesh HaKadoshim becomes more and more and more powerful as it spreads out throughout the world. Anyway, so Yechezkel describes it in the greatest detail. The Gemara is going to bring a posik that Yechezkel uses in his description of it. And then you have also briefer descriptions of it. Zechariah mentions it briefly, and a couple of other Nevi'im mention me. You have Yoel mentions, you have the posik Umayin mi beis Hashem yetze v'hishkos nachal ashitim, which the whole Kuntres Umayin is based on. It begins with that posik and explains it. So you have this concept is mentioned by a number of the Nevi'im, but Yechezkel goes into the most detail about it. Anyway, So most of the description of it, again, you have a sugya in the Bavli and Yuma that goes into it in great detail. Most of it is in the Yerushalmi here in Shkolim, but the Mechaber of Ein Yaakov didn't choose to put most of it in. But he put in the following piece. Yechezkel describes Va'ala Nachal, next to the stream, Yala al Sfose Mizeo Mizeh, that will grow by the banks of the stream on both sides, Kol Eitz Madchal, all kinds of trees for food. Lo Yibol Alehu, the leaves of those trees will never fall off. They'll never, like you have, like most trees lose their leaves during winter. Velo Yita Imperioi, and its fruit will never cease to be on the tree. Lo Chadosh of Yivaker, by its months, which we're going to see in the Gemara soon what that means, it will bear fruit. Kimeim of Minamikdash, Hema Yotzim, because the water of this stream comes from the Beis Hamikdash, so therefore it has special powers. V'hoya piryei l'machal, so therefore the fruit of this tree will be for food. V'olehu, and the leaves of it will be latrufa, where the simple meaning of latrufa means for healing. But the Gemara is going to dash in soon what the word latrufa means. So in short, in other words, this water is going to be a life-giving and healing thing. Earlier, the Pesukim describe also how this water is going to go to all the various bodies of salt water in the world and sweeten them. The Dead Sea will become sweet, the Mediterranean, and then the oceans will become sweet, etc. That now there'll be drinkable water. So as a result of the stream. But now you have this pasuk that mentions that in addition, the trees that grow beside this stream are also going to be something special. So when it says l'chadosh of yivaker, by its months it'll give first fruit. So what does that mean? What does that mean, l'chadosh of? Toni Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda teaches a braisa. L'fisha ba'olam hazeh tvur oisa l'shisha chadoshim. In this world nowadays, it takes grain 6 months to grow. The ilam l'shnei masa chadoshim, and fruit on a tree takes 12 months to grow. Now, La'osid Lavei, this special river and the trees by it, Abba La'osid Lavei, Tavua Oysa L'chodesh Echad, V'ilon Oysa L'beiz Chadoshim. Everything when it comes to all the places that are watered by this river, it's going to be six times as fast. So the proportion will still, the ratio will still be the same, that grain will take half as long as fruits to grow. So therefore, so when it says l'chadoshav, in other words, he understands l'chadoshav being in the plural means every 2 months there will be a new crop of fruit on these trees. So therefore, if every 2 months you have fruit, then it means it must be every month there'll be grain, because again, grain grows twice as fast as fruit. My time, l'chadosh of Yavaka, he says, because that we learn from the word l'chadosh of, that every 2 months. On the other hand, Amar Rabbi Yossi says differently. Yes, in this world you have the proportion that it's one that fruit takes twice as long as tvua, and that it's 6 and 12 months respectively. But he learns the chadoshav doesn't mean every 2 months, but rather every month. He says the chadoshav just means all the months throughout the year. So therefore, so he learns Avol Osad Lava Ilan Oisel Chodesh Echad, trees will be able to produce fruit every month. The utvua oisa l'chamisha osa yoim, and grain will take only 15 days to grow. And in fact, Rabbi Yossi says, you have an example of it already in earlier times. As we know, the Gemara mentions in a few places that all the things that are going to happen, l'osid lavoi, we have a me'ain of them even nowadays. You have, for example, the Gemara where Rav Gamliel is teaching that asida isha shetela b'chol yoim, that women will give birth every day, And a Talmud makes fun of it and says, how is that possible? And Rav Gamliel shows him we have a me'ain of it nowadays where a chicken can lay an egg every day. So the same thing over here. Rabbi Yossi says, you have a me'ain of this. You want to have an example where tvua, where grain takes only 15 days to grow. Shekein matzina b'mei yoyol. We find in the time of yoyol, Anovi. We learned about this in Bavli and Tainus. that the grain grew in only 15 days, and they were able to bring the omer from it. As we learned in Tainis, what happened was that there had been a drought and a plague of locusts, and finally the Jewish people did tshuva. So now it comes the beginning of Nisan, and Yoel tells them, go plant whatever wheat and barley seeds you have, and the people had emunah, and they did, even though on the face of it, what are they going to eat until it grows? It's going to take months, b'derech klal, until it grows. So Nes happened, and it grew in only a few days. The Bavli actually says it grew in 11 days. The Bavli says they planted on the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of Nisan, and it was already ready for harvest on the 16th of Nisan, which means that some of it took only 11 days to grow. Here, the Yerushalmi is saying that it took 15 days, close enough.
Genetically modified,
I guess, yeah, you could say. Shenema, as the pasuk says, "Uvnei Tzion gilu v'smachu b'Hashem alekechem." You people of Tzion, rejoice and be happy in Hashem your God. Ki nosan lachem es ha-moda v'gomer, because he gave you the moda, which is the early rain, like Yodo Malkush, like we have in Kurishma. And the pasuk says he gave you the moda malkush barishon, meaning that in the first month in Nisan there fell both the yoda, the uli rain, which usually falls cheshvan time, and the malkush, which usually falls Nisan time. Here the Eibishter made both of those come back to back, only a couple of days apart, and the tevuah grew unusually fast. So therefore, Rabbi Yossi says, you see then that tevuah grew in only 2 weeks. Therefore, the osed lover, it can be the same kind of thing. And again, given that fruits take twice as long to grow as tevuah, then if the tevuah is going to take only 15 days, then the peiros must be monthly. And therefore, the word l'chadoshav doesn't mean 2 months. Like Rabbi Yehuda says, it just means every month throughout the year. So the Gemara says, "My makayim Rabbi Yosi l'chadoshav yivaker." So what is Rabbi Yosi doing with the word l'chadoshav, which suggests plural, 2 months? Amalach, he says it means kochodesh v'chodesh yivaker. That's what it means. It means every month of all the months during the year, it's going to be producing new fruit. Okay. Now the pasuk from Yechezkel that we quoted at the top of the Amud continued, "Va'alehu lisrufa." The fruit, the leaves of these trees that grow by the stream that comes from the Beis Mikdash will be lisrufa. So what does that mean? So Rabbi Yochanan Amar, tarpe motzitz olive teref mizone. It means tarpe would mean the word tarpe can mean food, like teref nosam liyreyav, except you have a tof instead of a tes. Sometimes like that, a tof and a tes, because they sound similar, can be interchangeable. So it means
by the
yoina, you have alay zayis torof bafia. Rashi explains over there that no, torof over there means torn off. But the torn off. But nevertheless, the word teref can also mean food, like teref nosam liyreyav. So vatitem teref levesa. So therefore, tarpe means the same thing. It means it'll be food. Motzetz ola, you can suck on the leaves, the teref mezone, and you'll have actual nutritious food just by sucking on the leaves. Usually the leaves, and nowadays the leaves don't usually have much in the way of nutrients in them, but the leaves from these trees will have that special quality that you'll actually get nourished by them. There's various other explanations of what this expression tarpe motzitz olei v'teref mezona means. Another point is the word taraf, tof resh pei, that shodosh also means to be revealed. Meaning, in other words, usually you have trees grow leaves, and only after the leaves fall off, only then do you start having the fruit starts growing and becomes visible. Here, Rabbi Yochanan is saying that even while the leaves are still on the trees, you're still going to have the fruit is going to be visible, taraf, it's going to be visible and revealed, and it's an unlike trees nowadays. Another point, actually, I haven't seen this anywhere, but the word, the Rabbi Yochanan's first word, terapia, tof resh pei yud, and then a hey, might actually be the word terapia, like therapy in English. It's actually a Greek word, in which case he's saying that these leaves will actually be not only nutritious, but they'll also be medicinal. As the Gemara continues, Rav Shmuel, Chad Omar, so Rav and Shmuel both hold that litrufa means meloshen refuah. So chad, but they're darshaning the word litzrufa, chad omala hatu peshal maila. One of them, between Rav and Shmuel, says that the result is of eating these leaves from these trees is it will open up the upper mouth. Now that can mean, in other words, we're darshaning the word litzrufa as meloshin hatu peh, to open up the mouth. What do we mean to open up the mouth? So the Aruch explains, in other words, let's say, for example, that a person doesn't have an appetite. So these leaves will restore his appetite. Other Mephoshim explain that it means that if a person is mute, then it'll give him the ability to speak. And the other one says between Rav and Shmuel that they will have the ability, these leaves will give the person the ability to open up the lower mouth, where again, the Aruch explains it means if a person is having a hard time going to the bathroom, then they'll loosen him up so he's able to go. Although Mephoshim explained that it means that if a woman or a man, for that matter, is barren and is unable to have children, then it'll open up the relevant parts and make it possible for them to have children. Similar. So in other words, both of them are darshaning the word lisrufa as meloshon lahatir peh, but the question is, are we talking about the peh shel maila or the peh shel mada? Similarly, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Rabbi Chanina, chad om lahatir peh shel akoris, v'chad om lahatir peh shel ilmim, one of them says that the leaves will have the power to open up the mouth of barren women, and the other one says to open up the mouth of people who are mute.
That kids belongs to Hashem.
Yeah, what we're saying is, in other words, eating these leaves of these trees they have a special bracha in them from Hashem, and the result is, as a result of that, a person who until now was unable to have children, or was unable to speak, or was unable to whatever, will now have that ability. Okay, Yom Yom Mashiach Geula, Yud Beis Tishrei. So we talked about yesterday. We learned an excerpt from a sicha that mentioned was Vizrakti Aleichem Mayim Torah Mutahotim. So now, continuing on that theme from a different sicha, the ultimate Tara we're going to have by the Gula Amitis Vashlema, again based on that pasuk, was Vizrakti Aleichem Mayim Torah Mutahotim. Now that again, just like we said, that when it comes to the things that are going to be lost in love, we have a me'ain of them nowadays. So you have a me'ain of this also in the times of Golus, where even nowadays Koyanim have to be careful not to become tamei. So this is not only because they have the mitzvah in the Torah l'nefesh lo yitama, but also we can also say that this is a hachana. This is their way of preparing for the ultimate tara that will be la'asid lovely. Some halachas of Sukkos. So let's see. We talked yesterday about the walls of the sukkah. So as far as the schach lachtchila should not be placed on top of something which is mekabel tuma. So for example, you have a sukkah, for example, which has a frame of metal poles and the metal is mekabel tuma, then preferably the schach should not be resting directly on the metal. So what you do is, for example, you put down 2x4s and then you put the schach on top of it. And there are other examples like that. As far as putting things like that on top of the schach is yesh lahachmer, also to put something on top of the schach to hold it in place. One thing they talk about also, for example, let's say to use zip ties to hold down your schach is not so glatt either, given that after all, you can't use those themselves as schach. They being plastic. So can you use them to hold down your schach is not quite so glatt. Another point is sometimes you have an eave overhanging your sukkah or something. You have something else that's overhanging one edge of your sukkah. So if it's up to 4 amas, it's valid because there's a concept halacha l'mishmisine called doifen akuma, but you can't sit under that part of the sukkah. So you can't sit and eat and whatever. You can't be yotze the mitzvah of sukkah. So you have, let's say you build the sukkah and one wall of the sukkah is your house and you have the edge of your roof, the eave of your roof overhangs it. So you'd have to be careful. You can't sit in that. You can't sit in that part, but it doesn't pass all the sukkah. It's still considered a wall of the sukkah unless that overhanging part is formed. What?
You're not sitting on
this. So the point is that it's still considered a valid wall of the sukkah, but nevertheless, it's still, you can't sit underneath it. Four amas. Three tefachim is empty space. Four amas is possible schach by the edge. Yeah. Another point is we know of course that if a tree is overhanging a sukkah, then it makes it possible. The Alter Rebbe makes the point basically that any schach that is under the branches of the tree is considered as though it wasn't there. So it's not just, in other words, enough that you have tzilosa merubah mechamosa with your schach as a whole. You would have to consider, if you happen to have any branches overhanging your sukkah, you'd have to consider that part, wherever the branches are overhanging, as though there's no schach there at all. And then you'd have to see if the rest of your schach, if tzilosa merubah mechamosa, and also if you don't have a space of 3 tefachim, etc. So the better thing is, you know, get a tree surgeon in before sukkahs and have him cut off the overhanging branches and that sort of thing.